Support for KPLU and Sound Effect comes from WSECU, with a reminder that WSECU is a local community credit union. WSECU welcomes everyone in the state of Washington who embraces the values of giving, sharing, and supporting local communities. More information can be found at WSECU.org.
Maybe it's the crusty old dude in me, but is it weird to be feeling your age when you're only one? Well, that is how old Sound Effect is this week, which is what you're listening to, by the way, here on KPLU with me, Gabriel Spitzer. Feeling old before your time is something that came up for someone we talked to 1 year ago, the very first story on our very first show. Layla Mirhadari was just 27 years old when her body started to quit on her. What happened next would give Layla new appreciation for both the machinery of her body and also the ways that modern medicine can be both wondrous and kind of barbarous. So Layla's story kicks off the show today, and our theme is The Doctor Is In. We're going to be thinking about how we look through a doctor's eyes and what it means to save someone's life and what it means to help someone let go of theirs. It's all coming up on Sound Effects, so don't go away. Let's turn back now to Layla Mirhadari's story. She was 27, a recent grad from WSU, and an active young woman. And then she discovered that her kidneys were broken. And that meant she needed medical attention right away.
Went to optometrist. He took pictures of the back of my eye, told me that they were bleeding. Then next day went in, got lab work done. That night around 10:30, I got a call from the lab tech saying I needed to get into a hospital, that he couldn't tell me what was going on, but it had something to do with my kidneys.
So she went back to the hospital there in Pullman, got, you know, poked, prodded, more lab work done, and finally the doctor gave her the news.
The physician came in, sat down quietly, and told me that my kidneys had failed, that I had, you know, maybe about 5% left. I didn't know if I was going to live to see tomorrow, or I was an organ failure.
So this, as you might expect, was something of a shock, because I don't know if I mentioned this, but she was only 27 years old, and that just doesn't happen to 27-year-olds. You don't just go into organ failure for no reason. And it has remained kind of a mystery. No one's quite sure what happened to her kidneys. As best she can figure out, you know, she had had the swine flu some months earlier, and it's possible that infection kind of bounced around inside her body. But the bottom line was she needed help, and she needed it right away.
So they were like, you need dialysis, and you need it now.
Dialysis.
Yes.
So that was a new word to you then.
Yes. Yes. I had no idea what the world of dialysis meant.
So what does it mean to describe it for somebody who's never had the pleasure?
Well, there's two different kinds of dialysis. Hemodialysis, which is, you know, a blood cleansing. And then there's peritoneal dialysis, where you use a catheter put in my abdomen and a fluid exchange. But you go in center, you go three times a week. I went in like Monday, Wednesday, Friday for 3 to 4 hours, and you sit in a chair and, you know, blood's being pumped out of you and going through this artificial filter and then being pumped back in you.
So in center, that means you go into a special place.
Right.
Doctors and nurses do this stuff for you. But
right.
Then eventually this whole operation came home with you, right?
Correct. Yeah. And so after about a couple months of being in center, once my catheter healed, I went through about 2.5 months of training where I went in multiple times a week. You learn, you know, everything there is to learn to be your own nurse at home. Yeah.
So walk me through it. Like, what was your routine like and how often did you have to do it?
So I did it every day. 8 hours a night, I would have to hook up to my machine.
While you're sleeping?
Yes, or try to sleep is what I always told people. You know, you can feel the pressure of fluid being put in and out of your stomach. So,
Is it cold?
It isn't, because the machine had a warmer. But if it was ever cold, you could instantly feel it. You would cramp, and it would be very uncomfortable. But I would normally have around 2 liters in my abdomen, you know, at a time. So that's a lot of fluid. You know, sometimes I would feel like I would look, you know, like 6 months pregnant, but it would just be all fluid that would be in my stomach, you know, and you kind of feel full and uncomfortable.
What was this like for you just to experience this, particularly as a person? And I mean, it couldn't be fun for anybody, but
no.
For somebody in her late 20s,
right.
How did it feel? And how did it feel watching all your peers not going through that?
Right. It was hard at first. I was definitely jealous of a lot of my friends that, you know, if we would go out or have a good time. I was also on a very strict diet, so there were things that I couldn't eat. I didn't have a lot of energy. I always felt kind of ill and sick. So that, yeah, it was hard. And then my friends could just go home and crash on their bed or crash on the couch. And you know, they didn't have that huge responsibility when they got home.
Yeah, it's not like you could just flop over on the Lazy Boy
no.
and fall asleep for the night.
No. No, it would take probably about a good half an hour or so just to say, okay, now I can go to bed.
How long did that go on?
For 3 years.
Did you feel chained to this thing?
Oh, yeah. In the absolute physical sense of it, yes. Because once you hook up to your dialysis machine, you really have maybe enough tether to get to the bathroom, if that's it. So once I would be on this machine for 8 hours, I couldn't leave the bedroom.
So all that time, you were, of course, waiting for another kidney, a
yes.
new kidney.
Yes.
Right? So how did that work exactly?
Yes, it's this, you know, this phantom thing that you never know is going to come, but you just have to have hope that one day, you know, this magical kidney will come. And of course, the wait in Washington is around 2 to 3 years, which is actually pretty good considering there's some states that can be up to 5 to 7 years. So then I kind of thought, hey, you know, maybe I should start looking for a living donor. And how do you ask somebody, hey, can I have your kidney? It's kind of an interesting intro to a conversation. Had a couple people come forward, but weren't really that serious. And then luckily in November of last year, I guess you could call him my step cousin, had seen what I was going through and was like, hey, I'd love to help.
What's a step cousin?
So he's my stepfather's stepsister's son. So yeah, no blood relation. He was just really adamant. He would joke with me and said he had the best kidney this side of the Mississippi and that he wanted to give it to me. Yeah.
How did it play out?
So obviously well, very well. I received his kidney on September 9th. But, you know, I remember we were in pre-op and everything, and I'm sure I had this huge smile on my face. And it was such an emotional couple of days because it was the culmination of something that you want and you wish for every day. You wake up and, man, what I would do and give to just be healthy. But yeah, I remember getting wheeled into the operating room and I had this like cheesy smile on my face and the anesthesiologist like, are you okay? And I was like, yeah, when I wake up, I'm getting a kidney. Like, I'm going to go to bed and I'm going to wake up and I'm going to have this kidney. And he's like, okay, but breathe. A few minutes later, you know, I was out and woke up and there it was.
I don't know what it's like to come out of anesthesia, but okay. Did you know where you were right away?
And... Oh, yes. Yes. And I instantly knew that. It's like, okay, if all went well, there's a kidney in there. It all went well.
Did you have to ask? You're like, is it in there?
Yeah, I was like, is it there? Like, you know, I looked.
Feeling around?
Yeah, I was like, wait, are there stitches? Oh, okay, there's stitches. That's a good thing.
Wow. And so how, as you kind of came down from that euphoria, like what was going through your mind about having this new part of your body?
Just so excited. So excited and elated and grateful, obviously, for my donor and doing this beautiful selfless act of his to help someone who was in need. And I mean, you know, he basically saved my life.
Does the organ feel like yours?
Yes and no.
Well, let me ask you a different way. Does it feel like you?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I've fondly named it the Hulk. Because it's such, it's very big and works wonderfully. My donor was a good sized guy, so he had a nice, big, healthy kidney. And it's funny because it's in the front, so I feel it. It's you know.
Oh, you can feel it with your hand?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Get out.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. So do you unconsciously kind of touch it? Or do you, when you're thinking about it, do you reach down a little bit?
Yeah, both. And sometimes I just kind of hold it and just say thank you. Thanks, new friend, for doing all the good work that you're doing down there.
Coming up, I probably should be dead by now, at least in evolutionary terms. We're going to have a scientist explain why, and that's just ahead on Sound Effect from KPLU. Don't go away. It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our theme today, The Doctor is In. So we were talking a little while ago about feeling our years, even before we're actually old by most estimates, but we did a show a little while ago about age, and I met this scientist who's out to understand what aging really is in like a really basic biological sense. Dr. Dan Gotchling heads the Gotchling Lab at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center here in Seattle, and he came by to explain why my cells seem to be feeling so tired. So, what is aging?
It's one of those things that you know it when you see it, but in a more specific sense, one of the views we have is that it's when cells or an organism can't take insults as well as it did before.
So wait, when you say that, they wouldn't have as good a time at a Don Rickles show? Or what do you mean by take an insult?
Senior people might have a better time, but what I mean,
yeah, right.
But what I do mean is that insults from the outside, so let's say damage or challenges that might change the capacity of the cell to function normally or the organism. So for instance, if you got a cut, when you're young, you heal very quickly. When you're my age, it takes quite a few more days than a five-year-old does.
What are the big open questions about it on a cellular level that you are wrestling with in your lab?
One of the biggest issues is both defining it. So the question you're asking us is one we're wrestling with all the time. What is breaking down or unable to deal with an insult anymore? And then the second part is it turns out that everything is interconnected. You know, whether it's organs in our body that are talking to each other, our brain talks to our muscles, etc. That also happens at the cellular level. So all these things like your chromosomes and your mitochondria, they all are talking to each other. And what we're trying to figure out is that if one of them goes down the tubes, if you think about this as a big spider web, and it pulls on the web, it starts to pull down the other parts of the web as well. And so that has a big problem for the cell. And we're trying to understand, one, how the network or web is connected, and two, where the weak links are to cause it to collapse.
One of the things I've never completely understood is that if your cells are constantly dividing and renewing themselves, and we hear sometimes, you know, that every so many years your body is completely different than it was the few years before, then my cells are being reborn all the time. Why are they getting older? Why don't I just live forever?
It turns out that there's something which we call asymmetry. That is, there are things we call stem cells that continue to divide, and they give off those new cells that you see. As a result of that continual dividing by that one stem cell, and in the organism I call it, we call it the mother cell, she only has the capacity to divide a finite number of times. And so while most of your cells are indeed sloughing off, it's because of the daughter cells that she's giving off that you see.
So she's getting tired.
That's right.
When does the decline in our bodies start? I mean, does it start at birth?
My view is that after about the age of 35, things start going down the tubes.
So that's where the hill, after which you are over the hill, it's somewhere around 35?
Yeah, 35, 40 years old. Yeah.
I am totally on the wrong end of that, though. That seems pretty young. Why is that the, is that kind of the sweet spot then? Is that the best age?
When I was there, yes, it was. I'll give you sort of an evolutionary biology perspective. So in biology, we have this thing called the biological imperative. It's to continue to propagate the species. No matter whether you're a bacteria or a human, you want to continue to have your species go forward. In humans, it turns out that we evolved to live to about the age of 35. And the idea is simply that we try to be old enough to have kids. For us humans, that's in our teenage years. And then the way our species evolved, we have to be able to get our offspring up to that age as well. We have to protect them until they're of that age. And so basically, you take teenagers, double the number, and that's kind of where that sweet spot is. And there has been what we call no longer any selection for living beyond that age.
So evolution doesn't really care about you after that.
That's right.
After you're 35, 36.
That's right.
So much in science and culture is about extending life and quality of life beyond that point. Mm-hmm. Are there trade-offs for doing that?
Yes, there are. And I think we're seeing that in our society already. So if you just do epidemiology or statistics on what happens in people we know, that since we've been doing it for however many hundreds of years, it turns out that after the age of 35 or 40, all the diseases that our modern society care about start to come out. So heart disease, cancer, Alzheimer's, etc. In one sense, our society and we humans are in this big experiment right now. Because only about a few hundred years ago, if you will, or depending on how you want to start the numbers, or a thousand years ago, did we have the capacity to have protection from the environment, have regular food, and those were the big things. Only in the last 100 years or so have we been able to protect ourselves against the next big thing, and that was infections.
So really only like relatively healthy, well-off people are around long enough to get sick.
That's right.
And it's that behind,
to get old. Yeah.
To get old.
Yeah. Right.
And getting old also means getting sick, right?
Yeah.
So many of those diseases that you just mentioned are in some ways side effects of a longer lifespan and having our basic needs met?
Yes, I would say that's true.
So you're a basic scientist. You're trying to understand how these things work on the most fundamental levels. Is, you know, what is driving that? I mean, are you out to find the fountain of youth?
No, actually, I'm not. For me, it's more a basic curiosity as to how systems break down. It's very analogous, for me at least, to the computer industry. There's all these complicated processes going on, and you can have your computer running just fine for days nowadays or weeks. But then every once in a while, there'll be a glitch. And once that glitch happens, it starts to take things down such that you can't restart your computer or whatever. And so what I'm very curious is, why do things break down, in essence, with time?
Has this work and what you have learned changed the way you think about it in your own life?
A little bit, in the sense that I'm beginning to appreciate sort of that interconnectivity I was telling you about, how everything touches everything else, and also about what I should and shouldn't eat. So I have to admit, I don't eat as many candy bars as I used to, though I still do have a sweet tooth, as anyone who knows me will attest to.
So a little bit less sugar, but not an existential crisis necessarily?
Right, exactly.
Well, Dr. Dan Gotchling heads up the Gotchling Lab at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, where he studies the basic processes of aging. Thank you so much for joining us on Sound Effect.
Thank you, Gabriel.
It's Sound Effect on KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today the doctor is in. And next we're thinking about the role of medicine at the end of life. Rob Miller was executive director of Compassion and Choices of Washington for most of the last two decades. That organization is now called End of Life Washington. And they help people make decisions when they're facing a terminal illness. They were a big force behind the passage of Washington's Death with Dignity Act. So Rob found his way to the group because in 1994, 15 years before that law was passed, his partner was given a terminal diagnosis. His partner had pneumocystis pneumonia, which is a frequent complication for people who have AIDS. And part of that was Rob finding out that he too had been exposed to HIV. And at that time, that meant a terminal diagnosis for Rob as well. Over the next 18 months, his partner's health deteriorated, and the two of them talked about what was looming, which was death. His partner wanted to die at home, and he wanted to be in control of how and when that happened.
There are good ways to die and bad ways to die. Dying in your sleep, a good way. Having an accident, maybe. But cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, AIDS, these are diseases where the dying process can last a long time, and the suffering that a person experiences can be extreme.
What were your options at that time?
Well, this was pre-internet, understand. So naturally, I asked his hospice, and what they told me was the hospice philosophy is that we neither hinder nor hasten the dying process, and we can't really provide any information. I felt abandoned. We felt abandoned by medical providers. And it turns out that Compassion and Choices of Washington actually existed at that time. And we could have been referred to that organization, and they could have helped us understand the ways in which he could have shortened the dying process, like voluntarily stopping eating and drinking or stopping his medication. But we were never given that option. And after his death in February of 1996, my prognosis was very poor. I had taken care of him. My father had died of cancer a few months before my partner. And it, you know, looked like I was going down for the count.
Can you say more about what the experience of caring for your partner as he died, how that made you think about your own death at that time?
Well, it clarified to me what I did and didn't want. But at the point at which my line was reached, I made up my mind that I would end my life at that time, that I would not endure what my partner had endured or my father had endured.
What was the series of choices that you made having reached that decision?
I found out about Compassion and Choices of Washington, and I contacted the organization. I was interviewed by two of their volunteers and also founders of the organization, Shyla and Don Cook. And so Don Cook became my client support volunteer, and he helped me understand all of my end-of-life choices. And I made an informed decision to acquire a prescription for life-ending medication. And I have to say that on the day that I got that, it was a very good day. It felt like I had this huge weight lifted off my chest. It's like having insurance. You know, just because you get fire insurance doesn't mean you run out and burn down your house. I mean, you want that protection. You want that if things really take a turn for the worse and my suffering becomes intolerable, I can end that.
Well, obviously you didn't use it. How did that come to be?
Well, in 1996, better antiretroviral medications, or medications for the treatment of HIV disease, were finally developed and approved. And at that point, my health started to improve. The listeners can't see me, but I'm 185 pounds now. At that time, I was 148. So I was a stick man, and I started gaining weight and feeling better, and was finally asked by Don Cook, my client support volunteer, if it would be okay if they made me inactive, which was a good day. I'm actually still a client with the organization. Even though I worked there for 15 years, I'm an inactive client.
Your file's at the back somewhere.
Yeah, it's there. I stumbled across it not too long ago and you know, read the letters that I wrote to the organization.
What was that like, rereading this?
I brought back a lot of interesting memories of, you know, where I was at the time mentally, but I feel the same way now. One of the things about death with dignity is that people who are extremely religious and devout and opposed to death with dignity, and they don't suddenly change their minds when they become a terminally ill person. They're still opposed to it, generally speaking. So one of the things that we know about death with dignity is that people who use the law have a long-held belief about that choice. And I'm one of those people. Like 15 years later, I still have this same belief that a person should be able to have control over some of the most important decisions that we make in our life: who we marry, where we work, where we live, how we die. I mean, these are things that are, to me, basic human rights, or should be.
Is the fact that there were these medical advances that brought you back from the brink and have extended your life by at least a couple of decades, is that an argument against giving people this choice?
The fact that I'm still here, that I had the medication for, I don't know, 15 or more years, would seem to argue that I didn't jump the gun. And the truth is that, you know, from working at Compassion and Choices for 15 years, I can tell you with no hesitation that people wait until they are very close to death before taking that medication. It isn't typically that people take it too soon. It's more often than not that they wait until it's almost too late.
You went on to become executive director of Compassion and Choices of Washington in 2000.
What happened was my client support volunteer and one of the founders of Compassion and Choices of Washington, Don Cook, ended up becoming diagnosed with lung cancer and dying in 1999. And so it's kind of an ironic twist of fate that this person that he was helping to prepare to die ended up becoming the executive director of the organization that he founded.
You were at the head of the organization for 15 years, and then you just stepped down a couple of months ago. Why did you step down?
Well, I'm running out of treatment options with HIV disease. The virus can become resistant to medications, particularly with people like me who started with AZT in 1994 and then took the next thing and the next thing whenever it became available. I've become resistant to most of the medications available. And the only effective medication or combination of medication includes a drug called a non-nucleoside medication. And for a small percentage of people, it ruins their sleep. And nothing that I've been able to do has been able to mitigate this effect on my sleep. I haven't had a good night's sleep for over a year. You know, running a small nonprofit organization is intense. It's hard work. And I'm glad I was able to do it for 15 years, but towards the end of last year, I realized that I couldn't maintain. But I'm proud that I was part of the leadership of the Initiative 1000 campaign, the Washington Death with Dignity Act that passed with nearly 60% of the vote in all but 9 counties in Washington. And so I was really pleased to be part of that. And now to see how the law is working just as we said it would.
So after having been involved with this work for 20 years, very closely as anybody in the state of Washington probably, what matters to you the most about your own death?
When a person's dying, it's all about the person who's dying, right? I mean, you know, the people are focused on trying to keep her or him comfortable and out of pain and manage the suffering. But the person who's dying also needs to take care of the people that are going to survive him or her. And one of the ways you do that is you wrap things up. You say, I'm sorry. Forgive me. I love you. I'll miss you. And if you can say all those things and really express yourself, you will leave those people with much more peace of mind and, more importantly, a peaceful heart.
Rob Miller, former director of Compassion and Choices of Washington. In October of last year, Compassion and Choices changed their name to End of Life Washington. You can find more information about it at our website, kplusoundeffect.org. Just ahead, a young woman faces chronic pain every day and decides she might as well get something out of the deal. We'll find out how up next on Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and the doctor is in on Sound Effect today from KPLU. a lot of us probably take our general baseline physical comfort for granted, right? But imagine if something as innocent as, I don't know, a friendly pat on the back could cause intense pain. Well, that's just daily life for people who live with a condition called fibromyalgia. It's pain interrupted by brief bursts of relief. Sound Effects' Kevin Kniestad sat down with a young woman who lives with that reality to understand what that feels like and how that changes the way you think.
My name is Lauren Jansen, and I'm 24 years old. I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia a few days before my 18th birthday. Fibromyalgia is a central nerve disorder that is characterized by widespread pain, chronic pain. Some people have problems with swallowing, bladder problems, and so the reason why I found out I had it is because I was having sleep problems and I was having a lot of pain in my joints and muscles when I was growing up.
So tell me what you deal with.
My elbows and my forearms are regularly in pain, and my knees and my calf muscles are regularly in pain. And then when I've been working my hips, and I accidentally yelped the other weekend when somebody pinched me just playfully. It kind of feels like there's tacks attached to their fingers when they pinch me. It feels like they're actually digging into my skin with a sharp object. That shocking pain just lingers and it just spreads.
Do certain things trigger
stress? Like, my mom hates telling me about anything that's going on in our family because she knows that it just sends me into a downward spiral, and she tries to avoid telling me things until it's an absolute necessity.
How does stress turn into pain?
Your mind is in charge of your body. So if your mind is sick, then your body, and when you have fibromyalgia especially, is going to follow suit. And I think that goes for anybody. When you're stressed out, you get tired and you get worried and it kind of overwhelms you. But when you have fibromyalgia, it overwhelms all of your senses. It overwhelms all of your nerves. And so pain is just so quick to follow when your mind is in turmoil.
Was there a specific tipping point for you where starting to care about your health really mattered?
Yes. January 2nd of 2012, I was dating somebody who I was very serious about. We had a wedding date set for that year. He got in an extremely serious car accident and almost lost his life. He was helicopter life-flighted to Harborview. He was in a coma. All of his limbs were broken. And I realized I can't let this disorder completely take over my life and expect other people to care for me, because even if I have a husband who's willing to care for me, you never know what's going to happen. And I realized that I was putting all of my worth in the idea of who I could find to take care of me. I realized that I had to do something for myself, and I had to stop letting this disorder take over my life, because I realized if I could get through the pain, the emotional pain of that car accident, really made me realize that I can do more than what I'm doing. At that point, I decided that I was going to enroll myself in college. I was going to start working out. I was going to do things that were hard and that I never thought I would be able to do. That's when I started to feel better. It was when my vision wasn't so cloudy and when I really started to be able to see that I did have purpose and there was a reason that I was here and that I could overcome this disorder and this diagnosis, that I started to actually feel significantly better. I also realized, like, I want it to be worth something. If I'm going to be hurting this bad, I might as well be pushing myself and getting some sort of gain out of it. So I started exercising and I started really pushing myself at the gym because I needed it to be worth something.
You needed the pain to be worth
it. But it takes a lot to get out of those ruts. It takes a lot of focus and a lot of care for yourself in order to get out of those little fibrofogs and the pain. And it's like a whirlwind effect. Like, everything kind of goes at once.
So I can imagine that this is something that could be difficult for friends, people in relationships, to totally understand.
It is. I feel like it's hard to tell somebody that you're sick every few weeks or so, and that you're just asking for sympathy, maybe. And I feel like sometimes I get treated like I'm lazy or like I'm not carrying my weight. When you try to explain, oh, I have this pain disorder, and they ask more questions because they're curious, they want to know what's going on. And then when they ask, oh, how do you get diagnosed? Well, you get diagnosed by basically excluding all the other options. And so then they get a little bit skeptical, I feel like, and they might not mean to, but I always get these looks like, oh, so you don't know why and you don't know what causes it and it just makes you hurt and that makes your job performance slack a little bit. And just the way that they ask you the questions and the way that it all adds up for them, you can tell they're just like, isn't that convenient? No, it's the most inconvenient thing that's ever happened to me. I hate having to tell my friends birthday weekends that they're all excited about, like, I can't come out. And if I do come out, then I have to go home early because I'm really not feeling good. I don't want people to stop inviting me to these things because I am 24. I'm at my peak. And a lot of times I get to live my life to the fullest, but there are definitely weekends where I have to stay in.
Do you approach relationships differently now than you did in the past?
Oh, yeah. In the past, when I was younger, probably before I started going to college, I dated guys who were just deadbeats. Just, I almost thought I was a deadbeat. I kind of felt like I was a dead end girlfriend. Like, you're going to have to live a sedentary lifestyle with me. I'm not going to really be available to go hiking. I'm not going to be available to, like, go do crazy fun things and go on adventures with you because of my illness. And I dated men according to my worth. I dated men who I thought weren't worth very much because I didn't think that I was worth very much. And now it's amazing the people that fall into your life once you start realizing that you actually have a reason to be here and that you have purpose, and once you start living your life to the fullest.
What do you want people to understand about this ailment?
Sometimes people assume that you're doing something to make it worse, and it doesn't necessarily control you, but it's a seesaw. There's days where you're going to be up, and there's days where you're going to be down, and you're going to feel like you can't get up. There's going to be no one on the other side to help you up, and those are the hardest times. And so if you know somebody who has a disorder or a disease or an invisible illness, or they're going through depression, something that you would never be able to see from the outside, something that the world would never be able to tell that they're going through, don't give them your sympathy. Give them your love and give them your presence and just be in the moment with them and try to help them through it the best that you can.
Lauren Jansen spoke with sound effect producer Kevin Kniestedt. You're listening to Sound Effect from KPLU. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and the theme today is The Doctor is In. And this last story is one that may make you think a little bit differently about doctors. And it starts with a letter to Pamela Weibel, a pretty typical one.
Dear Pamela, an anatomy professor did in fact inform us that we would commit suicide at a higher than average rate and informed us from the lectern how to accomplish it successfully. Considered following the instructions on three occasions, most recently when a 4-year-old I had in the hospital died.
Okay, so this is a letter from a fellow doctor, a doctor who's grappling with thoughts of suicide. And if that's a sensitive subject for you, you should know there's nothing explicit in this story, but there are a few touchy moments. The interview lasts about 10 minutes. So physicians are in the business of saving lives, but they have one of the highest suicide rates of any profession. An estimated 400 doctors a year take their own lives. Pamela Weibel is a physician in Eugene, Oregon, and she's devoted a big part of her career to helping doctors cope with thoughts of suicide. She told me about the moment she realized how big of a problem physician suicide is.
I was sitting at the memorial service for the third physician that we lost in our small town in just over a year. And I sat there in the second row of his memorial service, and I just started counting the suspicious deaths of doctors. And I realized I had quite a number of them, including both men that I dated in medical school.
What is it about the profession that makes suicide a particular risk?
Well, we have kind of an antiquated medical education model that's based on the kind of, I would say, tough it up, suck it up, you know, don't cry, feelings aren't welcome here, do your job, do it efficiently, almost like kind of a militaristic model of medical training. And that's very dehumanizing to the students. And a lot of medical students actually graduate with PTSD. So it's a traumatic educational process. And I think that's the root cause of much of this.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's really about the paradigm that's kind of drummed into them in med school and in training?
Right, because when you compare the mental health of medical students at the beginning of training, they come in with their mental health on par with or greater than their peers. And something happens during medical training that disables them, essentially.
Can you think of an example from your own training that demonstrates that, a way in which you feel like it dehumanized?
Well, besides the obvious sleep deprivation and the massive amount of material that we're supposed to learn, in my particular program, we had to do dog labs, which meant that every four students were assigned to one dog that used to be a pet, and we were supposed to kill it, to learn very simple physiologic techniques that could be learned in other ways. And this is absolutely a dehumanizing process that I protested and was able to get exempted from. And in fact, they didn't even refer to this as an experiment. The physiology professor referred to this as an experience in which there was no alternative. And they actually made fun of me. The dean told me I had Bambi syndrome.
Do doctors get care when they need it? I mean, mental health care. I mean, considering that doctors are dispensing care and counseling patients all the time, you'd think they would know exactly what they need and how to get it.
No, absolutely not. In fact, we're not allowed to seek mental health care for fear of losing our license. On our licensing applications, there is a question that is actually in the same area as the questions about criminality and DUIs and felonies. In there, in that section, there's a question about if you've ever sought mental health care. And if you check yes, you will have to probably meet with the board in person to describe why you did that. And I've known a physician in town, actually in Oregon, who was delayed in getting her license by 6 months because she checked that box, being completely honest. And why she checked it is she sought counseling during a divorce. You know, everyone is depressed during a divorce. She had to pull her records, which that counselor had since retired. They made her go get evaluated by another counselor for her mental health before they would allow her an Oregon medical license.
So that has a chilling effect, huh? I mean, how do people...
It has a chilling effect because, you know, honestly, I have a friend who's a psychiatrist. She's an excellent psychiatrist, and she actually drives 200 miles out of town, uses a fake name, and pays cash to get mental health care.
Oh, wow.
How would you like that? In order to be off the grid and not be tracked by the medical boards. The other thing is I hear from medical students and physicians all the time that they actually are jealous of their dying patients in hospice, and they could wish they would you know, jump in bed and be the one with cancer so they could get some downtime and some rest.
That is so shocking. And it's so different than the lay public perception of doctors, that doctors are either heroic, mission-driven, you know, saintly people, or, you know, that doctors are business people or whatever. I mean, what you're describing is really alien to folks who aren't close to the profession, I think.
Physicians are not allowed to really be vulnerable and to share what's really going on. So they put on the white starched coat and smile and have their bow tie, and nobody really knows, you know, what's going on under that coat.
So you have chosen to tackle this in some very particular ways, including these retreats that you bring healthcare professionals on. Can you talk about those? Like what happens on them?
These whole things began as just business strategy retreats to try to help physicians who want to open independent practices. But interestingly, on that day that I went to this gentleman's memorial, that evening I had a retreat, and I showed up, and I had fallen into this physician suicide topic in such a bizarre way. I just thought I would check in with the people attending the retreat, and I opened the retreat by asking, how many of you have lost a colleague to suicide? And everyone's hand was raised. And then I asked, well, how many of you have considered suicide? And every single hand remained up, including mine, except for the one female nurse practitioner.
Did that change the nature of those retreats then?
Well, I started to realize that a lot of people came to the retreats for emotional healing, and that really was in the way of them starting their independent practices. The emotional healing is required before we can really be the doctors that we dreamed of being.
So when you're together in those settings, how do you set about trying to help people?
Well, I think a lot of it is just having these healers off the grid. There's no cell phone, no internet service. I've got 40 to 50 doctors in a lodge room on 150 acres in the mountains of Oregon, and they literally are just finally willing to tell the truth about their experience in medicine. And so there's a lot of crying, there's a lot of hugging, there's a lot of validation. And I think people for the first time feel that they're not defective. The system is defective and they've been abused. The other thing that's so beautiful is actually, because we were wounded collectively, I do feel like the treatment for physicians is collective, meaning pulling off the weak ones, quote unquote, on the periphery and throwing them into a psychiatrist's office isn't the best way to deal with our collective wounds. So I think when you can get healers together, they naturally heal one another. It's a really beautiful thing to witness.
So you said that when you asked that question about how many people in the room had considered suicide, and everyone's hand went up, including yours, what do you want to say about your own struggles with suicidal thoughts?
I want to say that I came into medicine, like most people, as an idealistic humanitarian that just wanted to help people. And the reason why I developed these suicidal thoughts, I mean, I did get into some major depression during my first year of medical school, completely related to those dog labs and watching the dehumanization process of my classmates, which was just brutal. But then once I got into medicine, you know, you're always thinking it's going to be better on the other side. Wait till you graduate. But I was pretty much like everyone else in the country, funneled into these assembly line medical jobs, which are not the definition of healing. 7-minute office visits where you're just feeling like you smack Band-Aids on people is not at all healthcare. And so I got depressed and suicidal because I felt like I cannot believe I invested 24 years of education, all this time and energy into a profession that I love. And when you're stuck in a system that does not allow you to be a healer, it's an absolute assault on your soul. And so that's where I was, the dark night of the soul.
What helped you emerge from that?
I had an epiphany that if the patients are miserable and I'm miserable, I'm looking at my colleagues and they look miserable, even though they're, you know, faking it sometimes and putting on these smiles. I just decided, you know what, I'm going to turn this over to my community. I'm going to lead a town hall meeting and I'm going to ask the end user, the patient, to design their ideal practice, to write my job description, and I'm going to work for them. And I've been so happy doing this now for 10 years. And what I call an ideal medical clinic designed by the patient.
Do you see any signs that this is getting any better? Is the training?
Yes. Definitely, because we're talking about it. And I think the fear of speaking about the trauma that we experience as medical students and physicians is dissipating, so that we're more able to have this open and with the internet, you know, kind of conversation. And the fact that we're no longer hiding all these bodies and hiding all the data is the big first step. I mean, if you think about it, you know, to use a medical analogy, there's no way you're going to solve somebody's medical problem until you have the correct diagnosis. Where would we be if we were afraid to say Ebola out loud or HIV? We would be nowhere. And so we've got to be able to say physician suicide out loud. And the next question after people recognize that this is a crisis is why? And when people start asking why, then we start solving it.
Well, Dr. Pamela Weibel is a family physician in Eugene, Oregon, and she joined us from there, from the studios of KLCC. She works with doctors in the Northwest and all over the place on suicide prevention. Thank you so much for being on Sound Effect.
Yeah, thank you.
Sound Effect comes to you from senior producer Arwen Nix and producer Kevin Kniestad, with production help from Warren Langford. We get web help from Dave Nagaris, and our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. I, for one, think you should celebrate Sound Effect's 1-year anniversary by subscribing to our podcast. You can find it on iTunes, where you can also rate and review the show. We're also on Facebook and online at kplusoundeffect.org. You can email feedback to soundeffect@kplu.org or just tweet @KPLU and @Gabriel Spitzer. And of course, come on back next week when we'll be reminiscing about the good old days with a look at nostalgia.
All in all, this was a wonderful bunch of people to work with. They were kind of rowdy, you know, kind of naughty, and a great deal of fun.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KPLU.